When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Good evening, everyone. We begin the readout tonight on perhaps the most misused, misinterpreted day of the American calendar, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a day when people who would have stood four square against everything Dr. King fought for, equal rights, civil rights, the elimination of poverty, and especially voting rights, soberly repeat that one partial quote they memorized in high school.
It was Martin Luther King that told us and taught us that we should be judged based on the content of our character, not the color of our skin.
That we should all be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin.
That we should be judged on by the content of our character and not the color of our skin.
And the immortal words of Dr. Martin Luther King ring in our ears that we must judge one another by the content of our character and not the color of our skin.
Yeah, that one. And of course, if you went on Twitter, you'd see those same people applauding Dr. King without noticing the irony of their platitudinous remarks. For instance, you have Senator Rand Paul tweeting that we should commemorate the life of MLK by uniting the two Americas into one, an America that includes justice for one and justice for all. He pretty much tweets that every year. Of course, Rand Paul is also the same person who said that he would have opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Then there's Texas Governor Greg Abbott writing that Dr. King inspired hope in our nation and that beacon of hope and liberty still burns bright in Texas. How nice. Except for the fact that he literally signed a bill that eliminated the requirement for schools to teach anything about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And then there's Mr. Cellophane himself, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who sent this uplifting quote from Dr. King's speech at the 1963 March on Washington, you know, the I Have a Dream speech that they always pull from. Quote, when the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. Clever edit, Marco. You literally cut that little section out of a larger quote. Here is what Dr. King said right after what you tweeted.
This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
It's funny how they also never quote Dr. King's seminal 1957 speech, Give Us the Ballot, in which he called for Black Americans to have the full and unimpeded right to vote. King declared, the legislative halls of the South ring loud with such words as interposition and nullification, but even more, all types of conniving methods are still being used to prevent Negroes from becoming registered voters. The denial of this sacred right is a tragic betrayal of the highest mandates of our democratic tradition. And so our most urgent request to the President of the United States and every member of Congress is to give us the right to vote. Which brings us to the need to confront yet another big lie. Republicans who are attacking voting rights like to claim that, well, no one's being prevented from voting.
And it certainly isn't about voting rights. It is easier than it has ever been in the history of the United States to register to vote and to vote.
Leading Democrats say they want to break the Senate because of a sinister anti-voting plot that is sweeping America. Of course, this is totally fake. It does not exist.
You know, funny enough, that is exactly what the old version of the Dixiecrats said back during the 1950s and 60s. Oh, no one's being prevented from voting. You just have to tell us how many jelly beans are in this jar and you can vote. Just read this complicated passage, and you can totally vote. Now, of course, we're going to make sure your schools are awful and you're barely even taught to read, let alone anything like this passage, but no one's keeping you from voting. The more Dixiecrats, interpositionists, and nullificationists change, the more they stay the same. Joining me now, Dr. Bernice A. King, CEO of the King Center and daughter of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, and Jelani Cobb, staff writer for The New Yorker and professor of journalism at Columbia University. And Dr. Bernice King, thank you so much for being here. It's always an honor to talk with you. So on this day,
which
commemorates your dad's 93rd birthday and commemorates his work and his life's work, what do you say to the people who are, particularly the Republicans and a couple Democrats, who are using his words and quoting them out today, but also opposing voting rights, also standing up for the filibuster and not for the right to vote?
Well, I think the first thing that we have to continue to do is educate people fully about my father. Unfortunately, there was a season of time in this nation where we amplified my father's I Have a Dream speech, even in the media. It became the predominant teaching of Dr. King. And so we are responsible for some of that level of ignorance in our society. But in the last few years, obviously, since the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech and celebrations afterwards, there have been more exposure to my father's words. The fact of the matter is the misappropriation and the convenient use of his words is always the case when people are trying to accomplish their own agenda. And that's what we see over and over again in this scenario and in so many other scenarios. And so my challenge to people is to really take the time to study and understand the whole and the comprehensive Martin Luther King Jr. This was a man who literally, along with John Lewis, along with Amelia Boynton, along with Jose Williams and others, sacrificed their life and bodies to fight to preserve the right to vote, to protect it, to advance it. And so anyone who thinks that Dr. King would say, let's move on, everything is all right, is sadly mistaken. Because he would not have made that kind of sacrifice if he did not feel that it was necessary to do so. And so we have to find a way in this nation to secure the right to vote so that we never again have to keep coming back to this place. So I even want to challenge us, even past passing these federal legislations, you know, what is the strategic work that we have to do as the people of this nation to enshrine voting rights in our Constitution so that we cannot have these kind of manipulations going on over and over again?
You know, and you even have some of these same legislators that are using your FOB, just that one snippet. They love the 63 March on Washington speech, but they haven't clearly ever heard the whole speech, nor and they only know a snippet of it. And, you know, Marco Rubio tried to parachute into a different part of the speech today to try to throw people off. But they only know the content of our character, not being judged by the color of our skin, but rather by the content of our character. What do you make of the people like the Glenn Youngkins and others who are using that as a rationale to ban the teaching of what they call critical race theory, but really is the teaching of history? They're literally banning books by Black authors. And in some cases, like in Texas, where they, you know, the governor also tried to use your father's words, they're literally banning books about your father. They're saying, you may not read this book about Dr. King, but I'm going to use Dr. King's words to justify it.
Well, that's the short-sightedness of it, because Dr. King was trying to eradicate racism. And so when he spoke in the context of the I Have a Dream speech about the content of character, not the color of their skin, they missed the fact that he had these triple evils of poverty, racism, and militarism, and that racism was very much a part and embedded in our systems and structures of society, and that we have to remove systemic issues. And so, again, it's very short-sighted. And the beauty of it is, though, that there's always other ways to make sure that people learn about Dr. King. And I thank God for the power of technology. And I thank God for those who have the courage, because we have to have the courage in the season. You know, I think it's time for there to be a massive civil disobedience and massive non-cooperation with evil. It's going to take courage, and it's going to take a strategy and a plan, just like it did in Montgomery and Birmingham. And there's going to be some sacrifice, but people are going to have to find a way, in spite of all of that, to teach it.
Yeah, I love having a historian around. It's always good to have a friend who's a historian, and we have Jelani Cobb here. I want to bring you in, Jelani, because it does feel like the misappropriation of Dr. King is sort of it's a seasonal exercise among those who literally, if you transported them back to that time, would have been against everything that he stood for. Because as Dr. Bernice King has said, he was for, you know, eradicating poverty and allowing people the right to vote and, you know, and things that they are diametrically opposed to. Talk a little bit about what people are missing about who Dr. King was when he is turned into sort of a greeting card rather than a human being.
Well, fundamentally, one, I'm happy that Dr. Bernice King has made that point about the triple evils that Dr. Martin Luther King indicted the United States for. We lose track of the fundamental point that he was a dissident. So he was someone who was critiquing the prevailing order of things, which is exactly why they were leading people on these massive marches, which is why they marched 54 miles from Selma to Montgomery before he gave that speech, indicting the economic order of the South. And, you know, Reverend Barber is great on this. He talks about this, about how the disenfranchisement of Black voters at the end of the 19th century was a prerequisite for creating an economic system that was going to disadvantage all poor people across lines of color. And Dr. King talked about that. They don't want to grapple with the Dr. King that said that we needed to look into a universal basic income, that we needed a fairer redistribution of wealth in this country. All those kinds of things that he issued, those demands that he issued, that were indictments of the prevailing order, that none of that is heard. What we've heard is the simple saccharine version of this imaginary character whom they're calling Dr. King.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, and his stand against the war. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. His stand against the Vietnam War. You know, Jelani, we still have two states in this country, Mississippi and Alabama, that use today to actually celebrate Robert E. Lee. They use it to celebrate the Confederacy because they didn't want there to be a King Day. And that is the only way they were willing to do it. Let me play Ronald Reagan, who also didn't want there to be a national holiday for Dr. King. This is the way that he sort of, you know, grudgingly spoke about this holiday that we now have and that he actually signed into law back during that time.
I would have preferred a day similar to, say, Lincoln's birthday, which is not technically a national holiday, but is certainly a day reverenced by a great many people in our country and has been. I would have preferred that, but since they seem bent on making it a national holiday, I believe the symbolism of that day is important enough that I'll sign that legislation when it reaches my desk.
You have any idea who they are in this concept, Jelani, what he's talking about there?
I have no idea. I mean, perhaps they're people who look like the three of us on the screen right now. But, you know, when we look at this, I mean, Reagan was just the most obvious example of this. You know, we all know about the resistance in Arizona to there being a national holiday and there being the uphill fight. One of the things that we've overlooked about Coretta Scott King is the fact that the campaign for the national holiday began immediately after Dr. King was killed. Right. That she picked up that mantle and began pushing for that cause. And John Conyers introduced the bill to make his birthday a national holiday the week that he was assassinated. And so this was an ongoing protracted struggle that they had to engage in order to even achieve this grudgingly and over the objections of many people on the right them or their descendants, ideological descendants, are now embracing this fictive version of Dr. King with both hands.
Yeah, and I'm going to give you the last word on this, Dr. King, please. Yes, please.
I just wanted to add something to that. You know, that 15-year time was a time that she used an opportunity to educate the grassroots. So she built a movement from the ground up for those 15 years to ensure that people understood the importance of Dr. King, his teachings, and why we needed the national holiday. And so we're going to have a massive education campaign right now because there is a disconnect between a great percentage of Americans and those who may be on the front line of even activism. And we're going to have to bridge that gap so that the pressure can be even greater on the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, indeed. Amen to that. Thank you so much, Dr. Bernice A. King. Always an honor. Thank you very much. And Jelani Cobb, one of our MVPs. We really appreciate you always on this show. Thank you both. And up next on the readout, tomorrow is the day that senators will reveal who they really are. Will they stand with Dr. King and John Lewis and the millions of other Americans who've been fighting for voting rights? Or are they okay with watching democracy crash and burn? Bishop William Barber joins me next. Plus, how hard should the January 6th Select Committee go after their House colleagues who refuse to cooperate? I will talk with Congressman Eric Swalwell about that. And tonight's Absolute Worst apparently interviews well, but now that he's finally got the job, you're like, I immediately regret this decision. The readout continues after this.
Here's a question. Have you ever been prescribed a medication? Most likely, yes. Well, what about this question? Did you understand how it worked? The way your medication works in your body shouldn't be a mystery. Learn how VYVGART, efgartigimod alpha fcab works by visiting VYVGART.com/MOA. That's VYVGART.com/MOA. Brought to you by Argenix.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
If you can deliver an infrastructure bill for bridges, you can deliver voting rights for Americans.
Our daughter, Yolanda, is the only grandchild of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. She was born in 2008. When you think about it, she and her peers are today sitting with less voting rights than the day that they were born.
The Senate must do the right thing when this legislation comes to a vote tomorrow. Senator Sinema, Senator Manchin, our future hinges on your decision, and history will remember what choice you make.
Tomorrow is the day we'll find out which side of history those senators that Dr. King's family called out to act on his legacy are really on. Our democracy or protecting the filibuster as the Senate takes up voting rights legislation. Members of King's family and fellow activists have kept up the pressure all weekend with a march in Arizona on Saturday on Dr. King's actual birthday and a voting rights march in the nation's capital today. Joining me now is Bishop William Barber, co-chairman of the Poor People's Campaign. And Bishop Barber, my main question to you is, at this point, is the moral persuasion of the King family, in your view, you've talked to these people, you've dealt with both the administration and these senators, is that going to be enough to sway them, do you think?
Well, I certainly thank God for all that the King family is doing, but you know, I'll be very honest with you. Too many people have sat back all year long. We should have never waited this long. Many organizations that are screaming now didn't go to West Virginia, didn't go to Arizona, went in the back room with the president. President didn't meet with moral leaders. His handlers blocked him from him and impacted people. And we allow this thing to be separated from the economics and voting. Dr. King said we must realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power. And that's what this is about. It's also, we made a mistake early on of framing it as a black issue or like it's a special interest for black people. if these bills don't pass, 55 million Americans who use processes in 2020 will lose that access. If you don't do it, you will hurt 45% of poor people, represent 45% of the electorate in battleground state, 30% across the country. This is about who's going to create the policies, Joy, that will control the $21 trillion gross domestic product in this country. If we lose this, this is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who is both against raising the minimum wage to 15 and against voting rights. This is giving in to the Koch brothers. This is giving in to the Americans for Prosperity. This is Manchin and Sinema acting more like James Calhoun of the 1850s, who was an ardent supporter of minority rule as opposed to acting like senators in the 21st century who should be helping us move the country forward rather than backwards.
You know, and it's interesting that you talk about the not separating it. So, you know, Dr. King was very explicit in criticizing the filibuster and talking about the fact that, you know, they won't even let the majority of senators vote. They certainly don't want the majority of people to vote because they know that they do not represent the majority of the American people. They represent in their own states a very small minority. And to your point, you know, he called it misguided, those who want to use the filibuster to try to keep a minority of people from voting. The separation of that from Build Back Better. It is interesting that the two things that are being left by the side of the road are the two parts of King's 1963 call to action. The Build Back Better piece, which is about reversing and ending poverty, and the access to the vote. You link those two things.
Dr. King did. It's wrong on a King day to only talk about voting rights and not talk about poverty and economic issue. It was wrong to separate those two, to choose infrastructure first and then say we'll come to BBB and then we'll come to voting rights. The Chamber of Commerce doesn't bifurcate its money. They are against both of them. We shouldn't be bifurcating our moral understanding vision. And that's why poor and low wealth people, we've been building from the ground up, as Sister Bernice was talking about, and educating, are going to have a mass poor people's low wage workers assembly and moral march on Washington and to the polls June 18 of this year, regardless of what happened. Because even if you win the bills, it's not over. The bills cover federal elections. They don't cover state elections. They don't grandfather and go back and undo what was done, particularly with redistricting. If you don't win, we surely have a lot of work to do in which we've got to save this democracy. So our deadline is victory. Our deadline is not any one particular date set by the Constitution, but we must stop this business of having one issue rallies and one issue and submerging to just one thing. That is not, especially it's not Kingian. We're talking about 140 million poor and low wealth people in this country, 43% of adults, 52% of children. And Joy, all of the programs that were used to uplift poverty, poor people during COVID are gone now. And if those programs had not been in place, we would have gone to 150 million poor and low wealth people in this country. We need a major moral narrative reset. We need a major moral nonviolent activism. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. 2,500 clergy are connected with us now, 200 organizations, and 43 state coordinating committees are committed to that and saying to everybody else, if you want to join in, come on in, because we have work to do. We have a lot of work to do to save the heart and soul of this democracy.
And so as what you're essentially saying is that, because, you know, in 1957, in Give Us the Ballot, what Dr. King said is just give us the ballot. We'll take care of getting rid of those rotten sheriffs. We'll take care of creating an anti-lynching law. Give us the ballot and we will get for our people what this country had promised us. That is what you're essentially saying is that the opposition to the voting bill is because if people could vote, not just black folks, but poor white folks, poor, you know, Latinos, they would vote for people who would give them Build Back Better. They would vote for people who would restore those economic benefits that ended while Manchin and Sinema sat back and hugged the filibuster, right?
That's right. And not just black people. See, I say, would you please read something other than just one speech? At the end of Selma to Montgomery, number one, look at the pictures of Selma to Montgomery. It's diverse. Wasn't a black march. Listen to him at the end. He says that voter suppression and segregated society was created because of the fear of the Negro and white masses voting together in a way to shift the political structure that would then change the economic structures, architecture of the nation. That's Kingian. And we can't separate. We should not separate. The two go together. Poor and low wealth people, if 55%, did you know 55% of poor and low wealth people voted for Biden and Harris? Why? Because they believe that they want to get $15 living wage. They believe that they want to get expansion of health care. So you can't fail on your policy deliverance and then think people are going to vote. But something else is happening. Poor and low wealth people are saying, wait a minute. We know what has to happen in this country. We know what agenda needs. So we're going to start utilize our power, shifting the narrative and building power and changing, because if poor and low wealth people vote at just a higher, little bit higher percentage, they can mess up all the political pundits across this country. And they are decided that they are coming together in a massive way. And I'm glad to be in the midst of them and invite others to do it with us.
Amen. So y'all listen to that. This is important. We're going to go to break, but listen to that. Think about it. Why would they be so determined to not have open and easy access to voting? Because it's not just Black folks. They don't want to vote. They don't want anybody to vote that's going to shift wealth away from the super rich who fund these anti-voting campaigns and give y'all a little something, something. Not just Black people. So y'all need to think bigger than that. And Bishop William Barber is always here to help us to do that. Bishop Barber, always thank you, my friend. Thank you. All right, y'all. Think big. This ain't just about Black people. They don't want any of y'all to vote that are going to vote for benefits for anyone other than the rich. Always look what they're doing and follow the money. Still ahead, new reporting reveals a disagreement among members of the January 6th Select Committee on what to do about the three Republican members of Congress who are still refusing to cooperate with their investigation. More details next. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Mel Robbins. Let's cut to the chase. There is a change you want to make right now, but you're waiting to feel motivated. You don't need motivation. You've got me. You can change your life anytime you want. And when you're ready, the Mel Robbins podcast is here to help you with inspiration and simple science-backed tools to help you create a better life. Listen to me and you'll feel motivated, all right. Listen and follow the Mel Robbins podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Three Republicans in the U.S. House have defied requests to cooperate voluntarily with the committee on January 6th. Congressman Scott Perry, Jim Jordan, and Kevin McCarthy are all material witnesses, and yet all of them refuse to speak with investigators. So common sense would seem to dictate that the next step for the committee is to subpoena them, to at least try to secure their testimony, right? Well, that's reportedly a subject of debate right now among members of the committee. According to the Washington Post, the panel is divided on whether to pursue such subpoenas, in part over fears that a protracted legal fight would delay the committee's goal of issuing a report ahead of the November midterms. Now, on one side, some members, including Vice Chair Liz Cheney, have signaled an aggressive posture. On the other side, Chairman Benny Thompson and others have sounded notes of skepticism that such subpoenas could be enforced. At the same time, the committee is also deliberating over how aggressively they should pursue an interview with former Vice President Mike Pence, who does not want to appear in front of the committee, according to people close to him. Joining me now is Congressman Eric Swalwell of California. And Congressman Swalwell, I have a lot of questions here. First of all, it is sort of emblematic of the difference between Democrats and Republicans that the Republican, Liz Cheney, is like, be aggressive because Republicans are aggressive. And the Democrats are like, let's just be nice, right? So I think that's part of it. But I am old enough to know, remember, that Charlie Rangel, and they talk about this in the Washington Post piece, Charlie Rangel was subpoenaed when he was being investigated on ethics charges. They didn't have a problem doing that. So why suddenly is it a problem to subpoena these people in an insurrection investigation?
It shouldn't be, Joy. And let me just say, what an honor to appear on your show on Dr. King's birthday celebration with Bernice King and others. But Joy, look, first and foremost, this is the greatest crime ever in America where members of Congress were witnesses. We also now formally know it was an act of sedition that has been charged against at least 10 co-defendants. The Republicans would absolutely do this to us, so we shouldn't have any 100%. Sort of, you know, notion of virtue that We are better than they are, that they would do this to us. And most importantly, though, this is it. We get one shot at this before the midterms, where they're trying to put every barrier in place to keep people from voting. And they will never, I promise you, if they win the midterms, they will never peacefully concede power again. So this is our only shot. We don't know how this story ends. We have the benefit of looking back at the civil rights movement, and we know how it ended there. We have the benefit of looking back at World War II and the Civil War and know how it ended there. We don't know how this story ends. And so if you are an author of this story, I would hope that you would want to do everything you can to make sure you learn from everyone involved on that greatest crime against America, where members of Congress were involved.
And I mean, I agreed. 100%. This is the, as you said, it is the greatest crime ever committed in our Capitol on the Congress itself. And the, any reluctance to me strikes me as bizarre. I mean, let's talk about the former vice president just for a moment. Mike Pence is not in power in any way. He's just an average citizen now. I see no reason why he couldn't be subpoenaed and made to retell the story that apparently is retold in the Bob Woodward book, I believe in the Jonathan Carl book as well, that he went to Dan Quayle, the former vice president, and asked him, can I do this? Can I actually overturn the election? Was told by Dan Quayle, no. Put your prosecutor hat on real quick. Couldn't they subpoena Dan Quayle if Mike Pence won't come in? And shouldn't they just say, sorry, Pence, you're just a regular guy now. You have no power. You have to come in.
Joy, there are a number of witnesses around the former vice president that even if he fights you in the courts and you never get him to come in before the midterm elections, which, by the way, I'm not conceding we're going to lose. We have a plan to win them. But if you assume that they're going to put barriers in place and it's going to be very hard to continue this investigation, there are witnesses around the vice president who would have no legal protections, and that should be shut down pretty quickly if they refuse to come in. But again, the goal has to be learn as much information as possible and also make the appeal to Mike Pence. Do you want to be on the side of the seditionists, or do you want to be on the side of helping your country understand what happened at this greatest domestic crime that's ever occurred at our Capitol?
Let me read a little bit of this Washington Post article. Absolutely. It says here, the Justice Department alleged January 6th was a seditious conspiracy by its own telling because of the charges that they just, issued. It says, but so far, the department does not appear to be directly investigating the person whose desperate bid to stay in office motivated the mayhem, Donald Trump. Among other things, they found the Trump campaign has not received requests for documents or interviews from the FBI or the Justice Department related to January 6th. Again, put your prosecutor's hat on. Is it in any way logical to charge seditious conspiracy to the grunts who busted into the Capitol and say, we're going to charge you with a seditious conspiracy, but stop at the grunts and say, we're not going to charge or even talk to? Does it make sense to you that the Justice Department hasn't even spoken to Trump or the people around him?
No, it doesn't. And I had a meeting on Friday with a lawyer who we sat down before I could even get comfortable. He had printed out the elements of the crime for seditious conspiracy, which also includes inciting. And so Donald Trump didn't go into the Capitol, but he certainly incited the mob and aimed the mob and told them to go to the Capitol. And so I do fear that we are overthinking a crime that was committed in plain sight. I don't really even think you need to run much of an investigation around what Donald Trump was doing, because he put it on his Twitter. He financed it with the Facebook ads that he paid for. And then he said it in plain sight for millions of people to hear and the thousands on January 6th at the Ellipse to take as their instructions. And then afterward, you saw multiple people tell the FBI or tell reporters they were sent there by Donald Trump, and they left there only once Donald Trump told them it was time to leave.
Now, one more question. This is on the sort of health issue, because this is sort of also the ongoing drama and health terror for a lot of us of COVID. It isn't ending. I think D.C. has done a good thing as somebody who's now doing my show out of the D.C. area and said you have to show a vaccine card like you have to do in New York City in order to eat in restaurants. One of your colleagues, Thomas Massey, has a problem with that and says he's never going to order from these restaurants again. I'm sure they're weeping and gnashing their teeth about that. But your thoughts about that, because you did tweet about it.
Vaccinated people want to be around vaccinated people. And Massey says that in his sign of civil disobedience, he's going to cross the Potomac over into Virginia and not eat in D.C. And Joy, look, I thought serving with John Lewis, who crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge for civil rights, was the bravest person I ever met. But no, it's actually Thomas Massey. He's going to get his takeout over in Virginia. So let's put a statue of him in the rotunda.
Well, the new governor of Virginia is trying to make it open for business for COVID. He's making it a COVID petri dish. So Massey will fit right in with all of the little spores. It'll be just his ideal place to eat. Congressman Eric Swalwell, thank you very much for being here on this MLK Day. Appreciate you. Cheers. Up next, Have you got your priorities straight? If so, you are one step ahead of tonight's absolute worst. We'll be back after this. Glenn Youngkin is now officially the governor of Virginia. When he ran, the conventional media wisdom was that he was running as a non-Trumpy normcore Republican. But as we tried to tell you on this show, he was anything but. He was just Trump with better diction and a slightly paler shade of orange. But once you open it up, it's all the same stuff. Anti-truth, anti-education, and 100% pro-COVID. Now that Youngkin is officially in the governor's mansion, Virginia is really in trouble, girl. And not only because his inaugural celebration may or may not have been taking place in a Western saloon. Youngkin signed 11 executive actions on his first day in office. One included banning the made-up boogeyman known as critical race theory. Now, remember, this is the guy who promised to protect parents and children from the evil tentacles of Pulitzer Prize-winning literature by Toni Morrison. As if he ever stood a chance against Mother Toni. Well, here he is doing Trump's bidding, erasing history with the stroke of a pen, a stance so ridiculous, he was even challenged on it by a guy from the home team at Fox News.
Critics of your position, including former President Obama, say, look, critical race theory is not being taught in schools, and that this was merely a trumped up phony culture war. Is it your contention that critical race theory is being taught in Virginia public schools?
There's not a course called critical race theory. All of the principles of critical race theory, the fundamental building blocks of actually accusing one group of being oppressors and another of being oppressed, of actually burdening children today for sins of the past, for teaching our children to judge one another based on the color of their skin. Yes, that does exist in Virginia schools today.
Why do they all have that like blank look on their face? Youngkin is also on a firing spree. The entire parole board got the sack. And his attorney general fired 17 state attorneys doing important work in wrongful convictions, civil rights, and elections. But Youngkin's biggest and most lethal project appears to be turning Virginia into a COVID-y cesspool like Florida. Even as Omicron is smashing records in his state, Youngkin is ending the statewide school mask mandate. He's also rescinding the vaccine mandate for state workers. The rich businessman with no political experience, sound familiar, is working to reverse all of the progress that turned Virginia into one of the highest vaccinated states in the country. Some school systems are fighting the order, with several counties announcing that their mask policies will not be changing. The fight continues, with kids yet again caught in the middle. So for living down to our worst fears about electing a MAGA in sheep's clothing, for reciting an MLK quote that you don't even understand, for your Toni Morrison bashing, for stirring the culture wars for political gain, but especially for putting healthcare workers, educators, and children at risk, children who will grow up one day, Governor, and vote charlatans like you out, for all of these reasons, you are the absolute worst. And up next, why Youngkin is the epitome of making a mockery of Martin Luther King Jr.'s words to further a racist agenda. Stay with us.
Yes, we will teach all history, the good and the bad, because we can't know where we're going unless we know where we have come from. But to actually teach our children that one group is advantaged and another is disadvantaged simply because of the color of their skin cuts across everything we know to be true. And the immortal words of Dr. Martin Luther King ring in our ears that we must judge one another by the content of our character and not the color of our skin.
Yeah, the same old line, same old line. That was Virginia's new governor having the absolute gall to not only put the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s words in his mouth, but to use them to defend banning the teaching of history that made Dr. King's work necessary. And then mislabeling that as critical race theory. That ban was just one of 11 executive orders signed by Youngkin on day one of his administration, as he declared Virginia is now open for business. A big campaign promise of his. Here he is right before he won the election in November.
On day one, we're going to declare Virginia open for business. No lockdowns, no shutdowns. We're open for business.
Youngkin's win and the damage that it will do is not limited to the state of Virginia. We're going to be seeing a lot more of this rhetoric across the country as the midterms approach and Republicans declare their party open for business for COVID and white supremacy. I'm joined now by Michael Eric Dyson, Distinguished Professor of African American Studies at Vanderbilt University and author of Entertaining Race, Performing Blackness in America. And Tim Wise, anti-racism educator and author of Dispatches from the Race War. Thank you both for being here. And I am interested, and I'll start with you on this, Tim, is this descent of the American right into essentially the death cult world. You know, if you put up the list of the states with the highest and the lowest death rates per 100,000 people, it's all blue states that have got the lowest. And it's like a lot of the South that are the worst. And so Virginia was in the good states. So they were in the states that had high vax rates and low death rates. That's about to change. Why is that an attractive model of governing to essentially say you can die here?
Well, I think that these are people whose entire politic is just owning the libs at all costs. So if the liberals or the Democrats are perceived as the party of public health, well, then we need to stand against public health, by God, because things have gotten a little too out of control. You know, it's just essentially just do whatever the other guy does, do the opposite of that. It's like what 7-year-olds would do in a playground. It's that kind of politics. And the irony of it, of course, is that when COVID started in early 2020, the disproportionate deaths were happening in Black and brown communities. They still are disproportionate. But interestingly, in March or April of 2020, only about 28% of the deaths, 30% of the deaths were white folks. Now it's over 60%. So the irony is when you act like it isn't your problem, which is what we did for the first, 6 to 9 months, people on the right were saying, oh, this isn't our problem. It's big city folk. You know, it's those people over there. Wait around. And by the end of 2020 and all through 2021, what happened? We saw the numbers change. And now white folks are dying in droves, which just goes to show one of the interesting points of critical race theory, tying it into that, is this notion of interest convergence, that in fact, the things that hurt Black people end up hurting the larger society. If we could see that and get our head around that, then maybe we could do something about it. But they're too interested in owning the libs, and so they'll have none of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You brought up critical race theory. Let's talk about that because, you know, Michael, this is going to be now the way that they run because, you know, a lot of the sort of media world and the political world have said, Glenn Youngkin has figured it out. And so we're just now going to all run just like him and try to, in a more muted way, quote Dr. King a lot and ban critical race theory. We're seeing a huge, what we're calling a red wave of targeting critical race theory around the country. Obviously, DeSantis is doing it. They're doing it in Texas. In Texas, they basically banned like 800 books. Missouri's trying it. They're doing it. They're all doing it. And let us let you listen to the way that Glenn Youngkin did it by essentially trying to abuse and misuse Dr. King's words. Take a listen.
And we're going to work hard to live up to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he implored us. He implored us to be bigger and better than we are.
Dr. Martin Luther King.
Dr. Martin Luther King.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
What an honor it is to celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
You've written a lot about the real Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. What do you make of this abuse and sort of recruitment of him to try to use him to enact racist policy?
Well, you know, Joy, in the church, they say Satan knows more scripture than anybody else. I'm not suggesting a parallel there, but take it to where you want. The reality is Dr. King has always been a kind of fascination for the far right wing. They couldn't beat him, so they want to join him, but join him by absorbing his language, rearticulating color blindness, reverse racism, suggesting that Black people were the real threats. Black people are the real racists. Black people are the real victimizers, and white people are the real victims. This takes a kind of notion that Dr. King is the hero of those conservatives to absurd levels, and then disses the very people for whom Dr. King died. We know that Martin Luther King Jr. spent 365 days of his life every year fighting against white supremacy, social injustice, economic inequality, economic immiseration, militarism, and the like. Everything that the right stands for. And to ban Martin Luther King Jr.'s ideas, to ban Toni Morrison, what they're trying to ban is Blackness. They want to use Dr. King as the kind of bête noire and the kind of symbol of their attack on Blackness, the blackest man in the land to this day. So I think that what will happen, however, it will be effective because the anti-Blackness is so deeply entrenched the ability to use Black people as the whipping boys and girls of the collective unconscious and to see us as antithetical to democracy when we know the folk on January 6th who stood in that Capitol and used that American flag and dragged it on the floor and used the Confederate flag to drag it through are the very embodiment of what Tim Wise has brilliantly talked about as the very bearers of white supremacist ideology in this country.
Yeah. Hey, you know, and Tim, you know, I mean, their real leader did it literally in Arizona this weekend. He said, oh, the white people are at the back of the line for COVID, like now openly just stoking white grievance and saying they're trying to kill you with COVID, you know, and it's open now. But it is so offensive and disgusting and disgraceful the way they try to recruit, literally recruit one line from Dr. King to make him the bearer, sort of the label that they put on this. Go ahead. I'll let you talk. you get the last word.
And let's use a different line. How about that? Let's use a line from Dr. King's last essay. He wrote it before he was killed, and then it was published several months after. And in that essay, he said, the largest part of white America is poisoned by racism. And here's the key, which is as native to our soil as pine trees, sagebrush, and buffalo grass. In other words, Dr. King was saying racism is not a deviation from the norm. It is the norm. It is not an aberration. It is the systemic reality of America and has been from the start, meaning that Glenn Youngkin and others, when they ban what they call critical race theory or any claim of racism as systemic, they would ban the real Dr. King. And I just wish they would be brave enough to stand up and admit it rather than to pretend that they are foot soldiers in his legacy.
Yeah, indeed. And in some states they are. I mean, literally, they banned books, children's books about Dr. King. And then they turn around and quote Dr. King to justify doing that. It's insane. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson and the Reverend Doctor. We're going to give you a Reverend Doctor too, Tim Wise. Thank you very much. Appreciate you both. Blessed MLK Day. That is tonight's readout.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.